Now, the latest in our series of profiles of athletes training for this summer's Olympics in London. Today, a young swimmer. She won gold 4 years ago in Beijing in the 200-meter breaststroke. This year, she's going for gold in three events. NPR's Margot Adler has her story.
Rebecca Soni looks graceful when she stands at the edge of the pool, even when she jumps in. I notice how few strokes it takes her to get to the other side of the 25-meter pool. Soni lives and trains in California, but she's in New York for a promotional event. Even here, she trains at least once a day. At the moment, she's concentrating on problem areas.
I'm definitely working on the starts and turns, so the kind of in-between parts of this one. That's always been a weakness of mine, so I've been focusing a little bit more on that.
Normally, she's in the pool 2 to 4 hours a day, but her workouts now include many other activities.
I do a lot more out of the pool now than I did before, which includes in the weight room or yoga, Pilates, and spinning. That's all after swimming.
Soni has some of the fastest world times in the 200 and 100-meter breaststroke. She won 2 silver medals as well as a gold in Beijing. At one point, her coach, Dave Salo, the head swimming and diving coach at USC, said she was training too intensely. He had her cut back and her times improved.
She's one of those types of athletes that grows up thinking that you got to go 10 workouts a week. She needed to learn that she could be in control of that environment. She needed to learn that she could go 1 workout a day and that she could try some different types of dry land activities. So I think she's learned a lot and grown up a lot.
Soni is 25. At one point, she was so burned out, she was going to retire. The repetitive, everyday nature of the training at her level of intensity got to her. It was hard to realize when she was in a funk, she says. She found herself just going through the motions. She says Salo helped her learn not to have to be perfect every day, and also to
remember why it's fun and race your friends and have a good time. And if you really need to, say, let's have a fun day and pull out the inner tubes. Like, whatever you need to do, you just need to approach it a different way.
And seeing her relaxed and playful in the pool shows that this new attitude is working. Soni previously had a problem with a rapid heartbeat. That was solved through surgery. And another little fact, she has 2 breakfasts a day. Cereal and fruit before training, eggs and toast after. Somewhere I read that you mix different types of cereals together sometimes.
I think that's a habit from when I was little and that always stuck around. It makes things fun in the morning.
Soni's breaststroke is considered unusual. Very abbreviated, says Salo, with a very short kick. She skims the water, doesn't go down that deep, so there isn't as much drag. It's a very fast tempo. He says you could never teach a swimmer that stroke, but it works. Salo calls her a lioness, strong and protective.
If she needs to go fight or she needs to go hunt down something, she's at 100%, and I think that's kind of who she is. She's really 100% at what she does.
Soni is beginning to increase her hours of training again as the Olympic trials and the Summer Olympics in London draw near. So as she trains, hoping to win another gold in the 200-meter breaststroke, as well as medals in the 100-meter breaststroke and the 400-meter relay medley, Salo says the main thing is,
I want her to enjoy this. She's already the Olympic gold medalist and the world record holder, and she could do this for a very long time if she continues to enjoy it.
And clearly, Soni still does.
Overall, there's nothing like the feeling of having a great race.
Margot Adler, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. David Green is with us while Renee Montaigne is reporting from Afghanistan. David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's good to be here. We're reporting this morning on an extraordinary turnaround in some of the nation's hardest hit real estate markets, and that includes Arizona. The median home price in the Phoenix area rose 20% over the last year. It rose 6% in March alone. Tucson was recently named the best market in the country for investors, people who say want to buy a home, fix it up, and then rent it out. In fact, it is investors who are driving the market. But as NPR's Ted Robbins reports, the easy money has already been made.
So this is your house.
So this is one of them.
Keith Cubberly is a Tucson firefighter. In his spare time, he buys distressed property. When he bought this brick house in an older middle-class neighborhood, it was trashed.
Had stuff all over, and it was dirty, and, you know, people hadn't done anything to take care of the property for the last 40 years.
So Cubberly gutted it, and now he has workers fixing it up. When he's done, he'll resell the house. Keith Cubberly buys low-end real estate, and he says it's getting harder to do.
Anything $100,000 and under, maybe even a little higher than that, are selling very quickly.
Tucson real estate agent Steve Marshall specializes in finding homes for investors. He says a lot of homes which would have sat on the market a couple of years ago are now getting multiple offers.
So they're starting to list their properties higher than what they used to. Property that would have listed for $20,000 to $30,000 is now listing for, $50,000 to $60,000.
About a quarter of all home sales in Phoenix and Tucson are to investors. People looking to fix and flip, fix and rent, or for a second home.
There's still a lot of people looking for bargains, but they're not as easy to find.
Mike Orr is a real estate researcher at Arizona State University. He says prices are up because inventory is down. There are fewer homes on the market. Fewer foreclosures, for sure. 60% fewer than last year in the Phoenix area.
And although we still have a flow of foreclosures taking place, it's dramatically down from the worst situation, which was kind of 2008 through 2010.
Homes worth more than $250,000 are moving up in value too, but more slowly. Rising prices are good news for Arizona homeowners who saw their property plummet in value since 2008. But Orr says the investor frenzy on the market's low end is bad news for people who just want to buy an affordable home and live in it.
When an investor is buying, they will very often offer cash and waive the appraisal contingency. And that is very attractive to a seller because they know that deal is almost certain to go through.
Sellers don't have to wait to see if a buyer has good enough credit to get a mortgage. And the relatively tight credit is helping to keep the rental market strong. More good news for investors looking for tenants. Keith Cubberly wants to resell the fixer-upper he bought, so he's keeping a close eye on expenses. The market is just turning around, after all, and he wants to price the house so it sells quickly to a home buyer or another investor who will rent it out.
Yeah, ultimately, someone's going to move in here that's going to enjoy it. And so it's good for everybody.
And you make money.
Yeah, we make a little money. The neighborhood gets cleaned up. Someone gets a nice house.
Having an empty home occupied is good for any neighborhood. Though what's happening in Arizona isn't happening everywhere. In some markets, like Atlanta, Chicago, and Las Vegas, prices continue to fall. Expensive markets on the coasts haven't caught up yet either. But Arizona, especially Phoenix, experienced one of the biggest bubbles and biggest busts. So this turnaround is especially welcome. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
The writer Robert Caro has spent about 35 years writing about President Lyndon Johnson, and he still isn't done. As we heard on the program yesterday, Caro has come out with his fourth book on Johnson's life.
Years ago, one reviewer noted that Caro's research was so exhaustive that his book on Johnson's youth in Texas described the average annual rainfall in the Texas Hill Country in the years before Johnson was even born.
That's a complimentary statement. I mean, that particular thing was a very significant thing.
Significant because the hill country was dry, so farmers were poor, and the Johnson family's poverty affected his outlook all his life.
Robert Caro's new book, The Passage of Power, records the moment when Johnson became president of the United States. He was vice president elevated in an instant when President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas in 1963.
A famous photo shows Johnson's hurried swearing in aboard Air Force One. Characteristically, the author has been researching that moment for years. We talked about his long, long dig for information as we sat among the bookshelves and filing cabinets of the New York office where Robert Caro works alone.
It's very easy to fool yourself that you're working, when you're really not working very hard. I mean, I'm very lazy. So for me, I would always have an excuse, to go quit early, go to a museum, So I do everything I can to make myself remember this is a job. I keep a schedule. People laugh at me for wearing a coat and tie to work.
So you didn't put this on for me. You would, if you were here alone in the office all day, you would have the coat and tie on the same way.
Well, I think I take the coat off when I'm actually tight. but I do. And this office is just for working. So I keep a schedule, and every day I write down how many words, like Hemingway. Many writers use the device, and I use that device because I'm probably lazier than most. I use a number of devices.
Your wife has been your researcher for all of your books?
Yes.
When I have mentioned that to people, people ask a lot of questions. One of them being, is he still married?
Well, we've been married, and Ina, you know, has written two books of her own, terrific books on France, and she's working on a third one right now. But she is the only person I've ever been able to trust to help me on my research.
What do you mean, only one you've been able to trust?
Well, basically, I have to look at everything myself. I mean, I was that way as a reporter.
You mean every document, every paper?
Yeah, but then I realized, you know, you couldn't really do that, you know. Ina says, I've looked at everything in this huge file, you know, that no matter how hard it is, she has looked at every page. And she knows if she comes across something I didn't tell her to look for, if it's important or not.
When I look around this office, I think everything in this office is something that could have existed 30 years ago. And with the exception of that printer, everything in this office could have existed 50 or 60 years ago. Tell me about that. I mean, is that conscious? Is that deliberate?
Well, I write in longhand. You know, my first three or four drafts, you could see them, are on legal pads in longhand. And then I go to a typewriter. And I know everybody's switching to a computer. And I'm sort of laughed at. You know, everyone says you could do it faster. However, I'm not sure that in my case that faster is better. So,
somebody, a little bit of inside information here. Somebody said to me, if you want to send an email to Robert Caro, you will have to send it to his wife's email address.
Yeah.
Because you don't have one.
No. But I use, you know, it's not that I never, I have a computer here.
Yeah.
Because the Johnson Library won't let me use a typewriter anymore. They say it's too loud and it bothers the other people. So I took my notes on a computer. And I also use, I did go on the internet. You want to do interviews. You know, is the guy still alive? I just had that. You know, the photographer who took that picture of Lyndon Johnson being sworn in on the Air Force is Cecil Stoughton. People had told me that Cecil Stoughton was dead. And I, like an idiot, had accepted that. I don't usually do it. I'm not quite sure why. I always usually look it up. But somehow I didn't. I said, God, I don't have enough detail on this, you know, because there weren't enough people. Most of them are dead. And now we have a national telephone directory. So Ina looked at him and said, no, there's a Cecil Stoughton down in some town in Florida. So I called him up and I said, his wife answered. I said, Mrs. Stoughton, my name is Robert Caro. I don't know who, if you know who I am, but I'm writing books on Lyndon. She says, Cecil has been waiting for you to call. Now, if you read that scene in this book, as I hope you will, you'll see Stoughton talking about why he put Johnson where he did and Lady Bird where he did. You have a lot more detail on that scene.
There are times in this book where you quote someone you have interviewed, and I'm reading the name, and I think about it for a moment, and I realize this guy has been dead 20, 25, 30 years.
Yes.
What is it like when you have to, I mean, you start out as a newspaper guy, you know, deadline tonight. What's it been like to sit on this material for 30-some years until you're ready to put it out there?
Well, that's a weird feeling. And it's a weird, you know, it's, well, George Christian, who doesn't like, let me say, he is not an admirer of my work. I knew I needed him because he was Johnson's last press secretary. So he was there at moments that were very important to me. And he had refused to talk to me. And then he did call, and he'd like me to come to see him. You know, I had heard that he had had lung cancer and that it had come back and that he had decided not to have the chemotherapy again because he didn't want to have it again. He was just going to die. So when I went to see him, he was a very sick man. He had this machine, this oxygen machine with a mask. And he had to make a lot of use of the machine. And he got tired. And then he finally said to me, you'll have to get the rest of it from someone else, Bob. This is all I can do. And then he called for, I think he called for a driver. And a short time later, he died. And I've had that, you know, before where you feel that the human lifespan is my biggest obstacle in doing this book. You have to get to these people, you know, and the last of them are getting very old.
Well, Robert Caro, thanks very much.
I thank you.
Robert Caro's fourth book on President Lyndon Johnson is The Passage of Power. It takes readers up through the beginning of Johnson's presidency. He says he has one more book to go. He is 76 years old.
Peter Jackson, the Academy Award-winning filmmaker behind the Lord of the Rings trilogy, found himself in an uncomfortable spot last week. At an annual convention for movie theater owners, he debuted 10 minutes of his highly anticipated return to Middle-earth, The Hobbit. And the response was anxiety. The good news for Jackson is that the crowd wasn't unhappy with the movie itself, but with how he shot it. Now, most movies are filmed at 24 frames per second, but The Hobbit is the first big film out of Hollywood filmed at 48 frames per second. To explain what that means and why folks who run America's theaters weren't wild about it, I'm joined by Carolyn Giardina. She covers technology for The Hollywood Reporter. Hi there, Carolyn.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's start with the basics. What exactly does it mean, 48 frames per second, and how would it really look all that different from 24 frames per second, which is how, you know, movies have been going for ages?
Well, a frame rate is effectively the number of images that are projected in a second. Proponents believe that it is basically a smoother image. Where I think it's probably the most evident is in action, because at 24 frames per second, if you see the camera moving quickly, then sometimes you might see a sort of judder or something maybe breaking up a little bit when there's motion. And the higher frame rate does make it a smoother image. So for proponents, that's one of the advantages to going to a higher frame rate. Where the mixed reaction did come from was people who observed that the clips were ultra sharp and maybe didn't give the look and feel that they were looking for. I mean, keep in mind that it's really an aesthetic look. It's an artistic choice.
But one criticism I saw, I think it was a tweet, sort of likened it to looking like a daytime soap opera.
Sure. Well, it is sharper. I mean, the short answer is it's sharper. But what I would say is that what they showed was unfinished work. What we saw were clips that haven't been color graded yet, that the visual effects hadn't, in all cases, been put in yet. So, you know, it's not a final project, and that should be kept in mind.
Now, I imagine this isn't the only innovation that came out of this conference. And it seems as though that theater owners, in trying to get us back to the theaters, pull us away from our iPads and our living rooms, are trying to come up with more ways, more reasons for us to pay for a higher ticket. What are some of the other innovations that you saw?
One thing that's already happening is we're seeing a move toward higher resolution. Today, the majority of the theaters are showing movies at 2K, and 2K refers to the number of horizontal pixels in a frame. And already theater projectors are installed that support 4K, which is four times that amount. Another thing to consider is the sound. Dolby introduced a new sound format that they're working on. Effectively, what you'd see in the theater is more speakers going all around the auditorium, and you'd even see them going across the ceiling of the auditorium to create a more immersive sound. You know, across the board, we're seeing a lot of innovation in the area of what's possible to create a more immersive theatrical experience.
Carolyn Giardina, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Carolyn Giardina is a contributing editor for The Hollywood Reporter, where she covers technology.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
And let's now turn to this country, because it is a big day for a lot of high school seniors around the U.S. It's the deadline for deciding what college they are going to attend. Well, some of the nation's top liberal arts colleges are wrestling with some big decisions of their own. The new reality is these schools can be seen as a more expensive and less direct path to landing a job. NPR's Tovia Smith reports that these colleges are looking at ways to adapt.
Liberal arts schools have long had the rap of being a kind of luxury where learning is for learning's sake, not because understanding Aristotle will come in handy on the job one day. But economic pressures and changes in the world of higher ed have now put college presidents like Barry Mills at Bowdoin more on the defensive than ever.
There's been a lot of hand-wringing for a long time, but I think those worries have heightened over the last couple of years.
The worries are both existential and financial, with liberal arts schools concerned how they can afford to keep offering the same small, intimate classroom experience.
The problem, which Austin makes incredibly good use of free and direct discourse in order to
At Wellesley College, an English lit class where just a dozen students are hashing out a novel is typical.
So how has this tendency encouraged by her relationships to other characters?
I feel like in her own family, she really doesn't have limitations. She's the
But it is also, by definition, expensive. More than two-thirds of Wellesley's budget goes to faculty, and Provost Andy Shannon says Wellesley can't just increase efficiency by making classes bigger or putting lectures online.
There is a fairly widespread anxiety about the financial viability of our model. The personalized, very labor-intensive instruction that we offer, the rise in tuition that will be hard to sustain in the future. I don't think anybody is complacent.
We don't want to stop being who we are.
Williams College President Adam Falk says technology may offer opportunities, for example, collaborating with another campus to offer some more specialized courses, but Falk says it won't actually offer savings. As two economists recently pointed out, liberal arts colleges are kind of like the dentist.
You can't get dental services without going to a dentist, and that dentist can't be replaced by a computer. That dentist can't do two people at once. Technology has made dentistry much, much better, but it hasn't changed the cost of dentistry.
Some of these top-tier schools, however, feeling the pressure, are starting to experiment just a bit. Vassar, for example, will soon offer online lectures for an intro-level class, according to President Catherine Hill.
Some of the tests suggest that a faculty member can accomplish the same objectives in less time. So that means that they could teach more students in a given semester without sacrificing quality.
The growing cost of financial aid is also a big concern. These elites typically have more kids on campus with grants and loans than those paying full sticker price, and they collect just about half what they charge. Williams President Adam Falk says even schools with big endowments worry how they can afford to keep offering such discounts, but they also can't afford not to.
It's a terrible pressure because our commitment is to access from every economic walk of life.
On top of it all, schools are spending more time and money responding to parents' concerns about how their little philosophy majors will ever be able to land a job. Again, Wellesley Provost Andy Shannon.
There's a joke around here that a lot of our students double major. They have one major for their parents and one for themselves.
At Wellesley now, campus tours focus heavily on how the school helps students find internships and jobs. Wellesley's also adapting by adding a class in public speaking, for example, a little more pre-professional than liberal artsy. Others are adding new majors, like business. But Shannon says it's more about packaging than content. He says a liberal arts education that teaches kids to think and be adaptable is actually more important now than ever.
We are not giving up in any way on the basic beliefs that we have about the long-term value of a liberal arts education. But we also don't have our heads in the sand, and I think we have to continue to make the case as persuasively as we can.
Sometimes that just means connecting the dots for parents. Bowdoin President Barry Mills is one of many now highlighting happy stories of alumni who are gainfully employed.
You can call it marketing, but that's not the way I think about it. I think about what we're doing is we're educating.
For all the worry about rising costs, however, in the world of the most elite liberal arts schools, price is also a point of pride and a factor in college rankings. As Mills puts it, no one's driving up costs to move up a rank, but when spending per student is seen as an indicator of quality, none of these elite schools want to be known for being cheap either. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
Let's return now to our series, Family Matters. Today, we're meeting a family that sees a storm on the horizon. There are a lot of financial and emotional decisions ahead. It all hinges on a very conscious choice to keep an ailing family member at home, no matter the cost.
Sing your favorite song.
What is my favorite song?
Okay, I'm going to say the first couple words. It's your thing. Do what you want to do.
It's your thing, do what you want to do.
Ida Christian is 89 years old, and dementia is taking its toll. She's a frail woman who loves to sing and also occasionally talks about her career as a seamstress. But nowadays she needs a lot of help, and she gets it from her caregiver, Yolanda Hunter, who is also her granddaughter.
Nanny, finish this up. You got to finish that up, okay? You have to eat that.
Yes, yes, yes.
You got to get your medicine, so you have to eat.
Yolanda is a petite, energetic woman. She's 43 years old, and she made the tough decision to quit her job as a human resources manager at a nonprofit to take care of her grandma full time. But she still treats this experience like a job.
Like, this is the binder that we put together that I check in, like, every day. So every morning, I put in the time that I've arrived and then the time that I've departed.
And when Yolanda leaves for the day, her mother, Geneva Hunter, comes home from work and takes over. Geneva is Ida Christian's daughter. She's this elegant woman who sits up tall and proud even as she speaks of watching her mom fade away.
I call it such a cruel death. It's because it takes your mind away.
And Geneva is also dealing with the pain of watching her own daughter take on so much.
I remember her calling me at work the first time that she had to start bathing my mother from head to toe and really look at her, how much weight she had lost and that sort of thing. And it was very painful for her. And she called me crying.
All right, brush here, brush your teeth for me. Turn it this way. I never know what's going to happen from day to day. Some days, she'll just look at the toothbrush and won't know what to do with it.
Yolanda, the granddaughter, had only planned to take a year off. It's been over two. And one thing she's learned through this experience, it's hard.
I used to hear about people saying, oh, you know, we got to put our parents in a home. We can't deal with it anymore. And I used to think, oh, how cruel are you? You know, but now I understand how people get to that last possible moment. It takes over your entire life.
And that's not what Geneva wanted for her daughter, Yolanda.
I've always wanted the very best for her. I want it even more now. I do want her to go back to work and be happy. I want her to have her life back.
Because Yolanda's reality now is she feels isolated from her friends. Her career is on hold, and she's burned through her entire savings.
I'm 43 years old. I'm in the prime of my earning potential years. I've got to get back to work. If I'm going to have, you know, a 401k, if I'm going to have anything to retire on, I've got to get back to work because I virtually have to start all over.
And so this is the moment of reckoning. Without Yolanda there to take care of her grandmother, the family will need a professional full-time nurse, and they're still figuring out how they would pay for that. But Geneva says they are going to make this work.
Sometimes I just stop and look at my blessings. And sometimes I just stop and look at my mother. And she's still here. And she looks good. And she's healthy. She's well taken care of. And that means so much to me.
We'll be returning to Geneva and her family in a few weeks. We have some really powerful images of them at our website.